Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Every Monday night, we're live and local with news, conversation, and culture from this place we call home. Tonight, a UCSF doctor will discuss his new plan for universal primary care for all Californians. Then, Stanford senior Theo Baker will talk about his new book, How to Rule the World. It's a story of how, as a freshman, his reporting took down the university's president. Send along your questions and comments for Theo Baker now to stateofthebay@klw.org. And then later, we'll talk to Berkeley's own Oscar-nominated filmmaker, Sarah Dosa. She's going to tell us about her new documentary, Time and Water, which tracks the death of an Icelandic glacier. That's all coming up next after this news. Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll talk to Stanford senior Theo Baker about his new book, How to Rule the World. It's a story of Stanford culture and how, during his freshman year, Baker's reporting led to the resignation of the university's president. Are you a Stanford student or graduate? Are you happy with the school's culture? We'd love to hear from you. Then we'll hear from the director of the new documentary, Time and Water, which tracks the death of an Icelandic glacier. And as always, we'll end with our weekly news quiz. But first, universal health care is the holy grail for many politicians, voters, and medical practitioners. In a recent article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, UCSF doctor and professor Kevin Grumbach outlines how California could make that happen. Grumbach is a primary care doctor and also a professor, and we're pleased to have him here with us tonight to talk about his bold new idea. Welcome to State of the Bay, Kevin.
Thanks very much, Grace, for having me.
Well, yeah. So tell us, what is it? What is the problem that you're trying to solve for?
Well, Grace, I mean, the public is fed up with the health system in general, so I'd like to solve the whole system. But the place we're starting is to get primary care back on track. You know, there's a lot of pain points for people out there, including just the unaffordability of health care. But one of the things you hear a lot as a growing problem is people having such difficulty finding a primary care doctor, or when they have one, how difficult it is to get appointments. And primary care is the foundation of any well-functioning healthcare system. It's really in crisis from an access point of view for the public. It's in crisis for the people working in primary care who feel so little support for that sector of healthcare. So we say, let's right the ship. Let's start with primary care. Let's create a universal, publicly financed program for everybody in California and support primary care much better to deliver the goods for people's needs.
So tell me, how will you do that?
What we're proposing is what we call a public utility for primary care with a common fund. All right, now that may sound like jargon that comes out in the Journal of American Medical Association. Let me explain how it would work. What we would do is essentially leave the structure of health insurance intact so that people would still have their private insurance plan if they're employed or maybe enrolled in Medi-Cal or one of the covered California Obamacare plans. But once that money is collected by the insurance plan, we'd say, oh, wait, insurance plan, you're no longer responsible for paying primary care doctors and their teams. We're going to take the money from the health plans once it's been collected and put it into a common fund that operates as a public utility to make primary care a common good that would be publicly administered and would then function as a universal financing program for universal access to care for everybody in California for primary care. So essentially, your primary care would be pulled away from the rest of this chaotic transactional insurance system. You'd at least know, okay, I have primary care, I'm covered. If I change my insurance, I change my jobs, I lose my job, I go on Medi-Cal, I will always have this single payer for primary care that stays with me, that money travels with me so that I can stay with my doctor no matter what happens with the rest of my insurance. And really that stability to the note primary care is going to work for the public, and that it's also going to put a higher proportion of the money we're spending in primary care, which is aligned with right now a state government goal to double all health plan spending going to primary care.
Is this idea of focusing on primary care itself because so much of primary care can be preventative?
Absolutely. And this is the great, among the tragedies of our healthcare system. I mean, the biggest tragedy is just we fail to do what virtually every other high-income country has done to make sure everybody has a universal program covering their healthcare needs. But the other thing that makes the United States really stand out compared to other well-functioning countries with better healthcare systems is we have so neglected primary care. I'm a family doctor. I've spent 30 years working as a family doctor. And primary care, the kind of thing family doctors do, family nurse practitioners, pediatricians, all those folks, is so, has traditionally been undervalued. We put so much money into acute care in the hospitals, into specialized care, into technology. And I think most people would be shocked to know that of every dollar that we spend on healthcare, every dollar of your and my health insurance premiums or our tax dollars that go for Medi-Cal or Medicare, only 5 cents of every dollar goes to pay for primary care. We did a poll, a public opinion poll last year, and just asked people what proportion of all the money that's being spent on healthcare do you think is going to primary care? What do you think the average person thought, Grace, when we asked them what share of their dollars
I
go to primary
mean, I
care?
would hope it was over 50 cents per dollar.
So you were right there. You nailed it. The average person said, oh, I think 50 cents of every dollar being spent is going to primary care because primary care covers 80 plus percent of my needs. So people are shocked when they learn it's one tenth of that. It's only 5 cents on the dollar, not 50 cents on the dollar. So we've really just starved primary care. It's why it's so hard to get people now to work in primary care just because the resources aren't there. There's so much that primary care can do. As you say, there's so much preventive work to keep people healthy, to help them manage their chronic conditions, whether it's diabetes or asthma, to now help people with whether it's substance use issues or depression or mental health issues. So much of that happens in primary care. And if we shifted and rebalanced more of the money that we are spending and put it into primary care, it's generally understood we'd have a much more efficient, affordable, effective, and equitable healthcare system.
When you talk to Americans, most of them want some form of universal health care, but the majority of Americans favor that. Is this idea of, like, going back to why just primary care, does that make it more palatable politically, do you think?
We figure we got to start someplace. I personally have advocated that we should have a Medicare for all system. I think we're long overdue for that. But the reason we're starting with primary care, there's two major reasons. One, because there's such an immediate crisis in primary care access and the lack of support for primary care that we think that has to be a priority. I call it building the first floor of what could then ultimately become Medicare for all. Because if you can't make the whole single payer system work well, if that's what you're striving for, until we fix this crumbling foundation of primary care. So, one, there's a tremendous need to get started with primary care. Two is I think it's politically much more feasible for us to get forward with moving on this in the next several years, and that it's still a very big lift to get to a Medicare for all system. So, just as I said, this would not be as disruptive in terms of completely getting rid of all private health insurance plans. It would pull the money on the back end, as I say, into this common fund to pay for primary care. It means that you don't therefore have to say, oh, we have to replace all the private premiums that are out there with new taxes. And even if it is replacing what people are paying now for their private health insurance, that's a harder sell for the public when you say, well, it's going to be a several hundred billion dollar tax bill in California for single payer. I mean, again, I think there's a logic to that. But our measure, I think, would be much more feasible to implement in California and get through politically because I think it's not causing quite as much upheaval right off the bat. The second thing it's doing is it's actually building on existing state policy. There is an Office of State Government that has said, yes, we have to have all health plans in California double their primary care spending. And California is probably about 7 cents on the dollar. The state now has as official state policy an expectation that all health plans, whether they're private health plans or Medi-Cal plans, get to 15 cents on the dollar by 2034. They've also put on some tough regulations to control over all healthcare spending. So I think the time is very propitious in California, where we already have these established government policies that have actually had surprising amount of stakeholder consensus from private health plans, from physician organizations, for consumer groups. So it's really the next step in California. Now that we have this goal to revitalize primary care, let's do the next logical thing. Let's make sure it's universal for everybody, and let's make sure we have a much more simplified way of paying for it and getting that funds to frontline practices so they can really serve patients.
So you are working to get this idea turned into law. And I'm curious, what's the insurance industry saying about this? Are they in favor of it?
We're having that discussion, shall we say, Grace. I think, this would mean some of the business of private insurance gets turned over to a public entity to be the payer for primary care. I think some commercial health plans will find anything that, sets up a public payer to be threatening. They certainly would not be thrilled about a Medicare for All program. On the other hand, we're making the case to health plans, maybe primary care doesn't even make sense to consider as an insurable risk. What is health insurance for? When you think, like, why do we have automobile insurance? Why do we have house insurance? It's designed to cover unpredictable, very high cost risk. Your house catches on fire, your car gets in a wreck. Primary care is very predictable. Everybody needs primary care to one degree or another. So it's a universal need. It's a common good. It's not something that's an occasional risk, and it's a less costly part of healthcare. Even if we double it from 5 to 10%, it's still 10% of healthcare spending. So it's not you're at risk for a hospitalization that can cost $100,000 or something like that. So we're one of the pitch to private insurance plans is we're actually kind of doing you a favor. Why don't you focus on the business of insurance, which is covering people for these more unpredictable, high cost needs, and why don't you get out of something that probably didn't make sense to handle as a health insurance liability in the first place, and just move it into a common fund to care for the common good. I don't know. Do you think they'll buy that, Grace?
You know what? I think that you're a persuasive person and you do have an article in JAMA. So who's to say? Who's to say? But we're going to have to leave it there. And I'm looking forward to hearing how this ends up. Thanks for joining us tonight. That was Dr. Kevin Grumbach of UCSF advocating for a brand new kind of primary care insurance plan. Thanks for being here, Dr. Grumbach.
Appreciate you having me on.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to Stanford senior Theo Baker about his new book. It's getting a lot of attention, and you're going to find out why. That's right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan, and here with me today is Theo Baker. And when Theo Baker arrived at Stanford as a freshman, he had aspirations typical of a student at that high-powered university. Do a little coding, engage with professors, maybe investigate startup culture, and make new friends. But what actually happened was so much more. He was invited to secret societies, he hobnobbed with billionaires and startup mavens, he OD'd. But then he wrote a series of investigative articles that resulted in the resignation of the university's president. For that, he became the youngest person to win the George Polk Award, which is like the Oscars of journalism. He chronicles all of this in his new book, How to Rule the World, an Education in Power at Stanford University. And he's here tonight. Theo Baker, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me.
We want you to be part of the conversation, listeners, so feel free to give us a call. Do you have questions for Theo? Let us know. Are you a Stanford student or a Stanford grad? What do you think of the university's mission, its culture? Is it headed in the right direction? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So Theo, you know, given that Stanford's role as an incubator of ideas that have resulted in blockbuster tech companies like Google and Snapchat and more, there's kind of a mystique to the university. Is that one of the reasons you were drawn to it, even as a young kid?
Well, that's absolutely right. Stanford has cultivated this mythology around itself of the teenagers who are vested with the authority and the promise to create world-shaking new companies and technologies, you know, in their dorm rooms every single day of the week. That is what this place promises. And certainly that's part of what I fell in love with. I remember, you know, I was a 7-year-old when I think I first set my heart on Stanford. And I remember seeing, you know, these kids in their Stanford t-shirts lying, you know, lounging in the shade of a palm tree and leaning up against a self-driving car they had just helped to build. And I thought this was the coolest place in the world, that all of the great new things, you know, that are happening at this one place. And that part of Stanford, you know, that still exists. It's just that there's another part of the university that the school has been less willing to talk about.
Well, you write that access to the Stanford inside Stanford has little to do with talent. It's, as one person said, it's just totally vibes. What is this Stanford that's inside Stanford?
So this is the sort of parallel reality, which you could only access if you've been tapped on the shoulder and identified as one of these future trillion-dollar startup founders. And for them, there are yacht parties and slush funds and something called pre-idea funding, which was the newest new thing by the time I arrived on campus.
What is pre-idea funding? How can I get a slice of that, Theo?
Pre-idea funding is when a venture capital investor or another investor will give you money for a company before you even have an idea of what company you're going to found. And that's the sort of thing that's afforded only to these special, you know, sort of Uber mention identified as quote-unquote high agency and plucked from the crowd, right? In the logic of Silicon Valley, you know, this place has been the greatest creation and concentration of wealth in human history, Silicon Valley has in the last few decades. And, you know, if this is a modern day gold rush, right, the resource to mine is talent. And so the earlier you get it, the earlier you identify it, the more you have made your own career as, you know, a hanger on who is associating yourself with the next rising star talent.
I'm curious how people are identifying who's that person, who's going to be starting the next Snapchat or, you know, if things don't go the right way, Theranos, you know, so there's other ends of that story. So how are people tapped on the shoulder? And did you yourself view yourself as an insider or did you feel like an outsider?
Well, there's this whole integrated system that is designed to ferret out the quote-unquote wantrepreneurs from the quote-unquote builders, in the words of one of the investors I spoke with while reporting the book. And, you know, that means that there are all these sort of hidden perks and access points that are kept obscured unless you're in the know. You know, and there are venture capital firms that employ scouts, talent scouts on campus, usually or often upperclassmen, whose job it is to find the freshmen, the second they step on campus, who have the real promise to create a company. And then there are these CEOs who seem to spend more time with teenagers than with their own families. You know, I remember this one guy, you know, this CEO of a Silicon Valley company reached out to me freshman year cold. I'd never met the guy. And he takes me out eventually for brunch at the Rosewood Hotel, you know, where all of the schmoozing, you know, the wining and dining tends to happen. And he's sitting there and he's spoon feeding his 8-month-old caviar as he confesses that his first ever contract was for the Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. And I just thought in that moment that this place is so weird. Like, what is happening here? You know, but as he explains it, right? My job, he says, is running a company, but my real job, my secret job, is to find interesting people. You know, anyone can be monetized in Silicon Valley as long as you figure out the right way to do it.
And what made him interested in you is, I mean, you are a self-professed nerd who loved to code. And that's kind of what you said, I'm going to do that when I get to Stanford. I'm going to be part of that ecosystem. Is that how you got tapped on the shoulder?
So, yes, I mean, I arrived to Stanford as a coder, right? That's what I, you know, had dreamed of doing and being for so long. And, you know, very quickly, I got a sort of sense of this, this inner world. And my main entry point was through the organizing team for Tree Hacks, which is the school's annual hackathon. And ostensibly, the mission is fairly, innocent, that you are running, a weekend of hacking, of creating new projects for college students around the country. What it really is, though, is sort of a funnel for a lot of Silicon Valley sort of talent pipeline. Because, when you're trying to ferret out the people who want to just be the entrepreneurs because they're going to be rich versus the people who actually theoretically are the quote unquote builders and have the real, assets that make you a successful founder, Tree Hacks, for whatever reason, is considered a quote unquote high signal cluster. And so venture capitalists will take out the whole team for dinner and wine and dine them and offer to fund any of our ideas. And there are yacht parties and all of these crazy things. That was my sort of entry point into the world. I never went much further than, kid with potential, because very quickly I got sucked into journalism. But I got just close enough to see what existed and to then be able to report on it myself.
Well, we'll get into your reporting, but honestly, at reading your book, I had to just step back and think, this poor kid was surrounded by some of the most repulsive adults you yourself were sort of preternaturally mature and you seem to have a lot of self-possession. But as it was happening to you, did you often think, wow, ick?
Well, there's, no shortage of predatory and exploitative behavior in Silicon Valley, I hate to say. But that's also something that I wanted to capture in this book is, I think people are very quick to cast everything Stanford and Silicon Valley in terms of vice or virtue, that either all of the things that emerge from this place are good and amazing and brilliant and world-shaking and Silicon Valley is like nowhere else on the planet ever, or everything is rotten and there's nothing of value and all technology is worthless, right? And certainly there are plenty of psychopaths in Silicon Valley and you see some of them in the book for sure. But there's also, right, this just absurd texture, this silliness, right? And it's somehow the silliness that allows for the fraud, right? That it doesn't have to actually be malice or people intentionally going into this. It's that we've created these ridiculous incentive structures that hand, teenage drug dealers $20 million for a startup, like one of the kids chronicled in the book. And then we ask them to make big promises, and then we don't follow up, if bad behavior emerges. And so it's this sort of silly texture to it that is also something I very much wanted to capture in the book because it's just such a ridiculous way of doing business.
One of the commentaries that is coming out about universities, particularly elite universities, not just Stanford, but, the Ivies, the little Ivies, is what students are talking about, the professionalization of their academic experience. To join a club, you have to go through so many rounds of interviews interviewing for a junior summer job your freshman year. How is that impacting the experience for students, and how did it impact your experience to have this layer of kind of pre-professionalism added to what is meant to be sort of an academic journey?
Yeah, no, that's such an important question, right? And Stanford is so interesting too because, just in the way that Silicon Valley trends tend to, then filter out into the broader society, the same has historically been true of Stanford. That this place, is sort of a proving ground for the next trends of higher education. It was where the public-private academic partnership was born in the 1950s that every major research institution uses now. It developed the patent licensing strategies that allows universities to profit off of the discoveries made by their faculty. It created the corporate partnership programs that basically sell access to students. So all of these things start at Stanford and then proliferate out broadly. What we're seeing right now at Stanford is a hyper-concentrated version of this trend that we've already seen sweep the rest of higher education to some degree, this pre-professionalism, where students perceive, the reward of an education not as an education in and of itself, but as its monetary, reward, as is whether or not you will be able to get a high-paying job. And that cultural conflict is one that has really dogged Stanford. Is this a place to learn or a place to get rich? The answer for a lot of people seems to be the latter. And by the way, That same mentality helps to explain why cheating has become so omnipresent in the AI era, right? The incentive structures are aligned here for students to think of coursework as their secondary goal. And so it's only natural to some degree that this new technology has come out allowing, you know, cut corners on this sort of industrial scale, and that students have embraced it wholesale. You know, AI in that sense is this sort of great accelerant for all of the trends that have already been here brimming beneath the surface.
Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm Grace Wan. We're talking with Theo Baker about his experience as a student at Stanford. He's got a new book, How to Rule the World. What are your questions for Theo, and are you a current or former Stanford student? What do you think about the school's culture? Should it change? Or are there things that you just like? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Maya writes, this guest sounds a little disillusioned with his Stanford experience, but isn't disillusionment typical of idealistic young people who are coming of age, tale as old as time? Are you disillusioned, Theo, with your experience?
I don't know. I'm sort of ambivalent, I guess. You know, Stanford is a remarkable place. I'm going to graduate 2 weeks from tomorrow, and I'm very excited about that. I will walk across the stage and be just as grateful as anyone else. I think if you love an institution, right, you want it to be better. And what we've seen from Stanford, I think, is a real lack of accountability, where issues go unaddressed for years and years and years. And certainly, by the way, that was my experience in reporting on the Stanford president. You know, some of these published papers that have now been retracted based on my reporting had been published before I was even born, right, and had not faced scrutiny for years and years. But that's also true of so many other things. And an example I like to talk about is another story I reported on in freshman year about this professor named Stan Cohen. So Stan Cohen is this living legend of genetics. He has given the university hundreds of millions of dollars in patent licensing revenue. He is this transformative figure for Stanford. And I learned in freshman year, he had been found liable in a court of law in a fraud case. He told investors that he had a potential cure for Huntington's disease. That was the word used in the internal company documents, cure, not just a treatment. But he neglected to mention that this potential drug target had been permanently banned by the FDA in 1976 because it could kill people, right? Seems like material fact.
Yeah, it certainly
And
does.
So he's eventually found liable. He's levied with a $29 million judgment in a court of law, which he's forced to pay out. I go to Stanford about the sitting faculty member who's just been found liable in a court of law. Will there be any repercussions? Will there be any investigation? You know, do they have any comment? And Stanford says, well, we've never heard of this. We weren't involved. We can't say anything. And that was untrue, right? Stanford owned the IP at issue. They'd been subpoenaed in the court case. They fought the subpoena. They ultimately were forced to provide documents and witnesses. And this guy, this professor, Stan Cohen, had admitted not just to potential ethical issues and how he ran the company after giving false testimony on the stand, by the way. But he had also admitted to potential violations of Stanford policy. You know, he was cheating on his wife as she lay dying of cancer, and he appointed his paramour without disclosure to positions at both his Stanford lab and his company. And so Stanford, to this day, continues to cite Stan Cohen's pioneering research in press releases about why the school's research enterprise is so valuable, while refusing to answer questions about the fraud that emerged from the very same lab. And so that's the thing, right? You can't have the good without the bad. You can't have, you know, only one side of the coin and neglect completely the other side.
Seems like Stanford is like nonstop material for investigative journalism. I think we have to ask Theo, have you ever seen Wall Street? Do we need to explain that to you?
I have, yeah. Greed is good. I understand. I get the reference. I'm not that behind the times.
Well, it's not about behind the times. I mean, you're just graduating from Stanford. It's like, and I should say, I have a student, and my son is a student there as well. So you're young. So
oh,
this
wonderful
movie came out thousands of years before you were born, Theo. So are you Bud Fox in Wall Street?
Well, you know, that movie is interesting, and I guess this gives me a chance to talk about one of the things that, you know, I've seen people rightly raising questions about when it comes to this book. You know, Wall Street, the greed is good speech, unironically becomes an inspiration to some Wall Street bros. In the same way that The Social Network, you know, kids I meet in freshman year are coding their startups to the soundtrack of The Social Network because they want to be just like the characters, as if that isn't meant to be a, you know, a warning. And the same thing, The Wolf of Wall Street, another good example of that.
It seems like people need to take some other classes to understand irony.
Well, yeah. I remember this guy freshman year told me he was taking a business ethics course, and he said, oh, we're all there to figure out how they got caught, which was
astonishing. Oh, dear. Yeah. I mean, not Admission. Good. well, let's go back, Theo, because for people who don't know the story of how you took down the university's president, I mean, I wouldn't say took down, how you investigated the faulty research of the university's president, which led to Mark Tessier-Levine's resignation. That is something that you got a tip on and then you just doggedly kept at it. Tell us a little bit about the investigation and what kept you going through that.
Well, look, I think the cardinal rule, not to mix my metaphors, but the cardinal rule of journalism is that stories beget stories, that it's the unglamorous work that leads to the bigger finds. And certainly that was my experience in reporting on the president. You know, anyone could have started where I started in 2022 back in 2015. That's when these anonymous comments began popping up. You know, a handful of comments on this forum called PubPeer, where scientists dissect published research papers. And so 7 years later is the first time that these end up getting reported. I work with forensic image analysts. And, for the first story, we're able to show that, at least some images in papers co-authored by the Stanford president at the time, Mark Tessier-Levine, appeared to have been photoshopped, possibly to hide results and change, results of those papers. Ultimately, over the course of the next, eight or 10 months of investigation, my reporting established that at various institutions where Mark Tessier-Levine had run labs, that people under his supervision had falsified research data, and that at various points, when presented with the opportunity to correct those papers or retract them, he had, in the judgment of the eventual Stanford investigation that was opened, failed to decisively and forthrightly correct the scientific record.
Hmm. I mean, your book makes clear, as you just said, I mean, the investigative part, I mean, you were poring over bio research that you didn't quite understand, consulting with people, hundreds of hours of interviews. I mean, this was not just a sideline. I mean, it was like almost like a full-time job for you at a certain point.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And once we got on the story and it became clear that other people weren't going to be chasing it, I think it was obvious to me that this was something that felt important to the community. Mm-hmm. Certainly it felt important to me to keep reporting, because we needed to know what had actually happened here. Right. That, if there was something that was going to clear Mark Tessier-Levine and release him from a cloud of suspicion, that was certainly important for the community to know. And if he had, behaved in some way improperly with regard to his research, well, at an institution that spends billions of dollars a year on research, that felt important to know. Hmm. And one of the reasons, that this was allowed to fester for a long time, these problems did not receive adequate scrutiny. Just as many problems when it comes to scientific misconduct have not received adequate scrutiny, is frankly because not enough people were looking, right? And so I tell the story, one of the papers, and I won't go into too much detail here, but one of the main sticking points of this investigation is this 2009 study, this famous paper in which Mark Tessier-Levine, a senior author, had effectively claimed to have identified the cause of Alzheimer's disease, right? So this huge, huge famous study, right? So every newspaper at the time wrote about it, lavishing, Genentech, where he worked at the time, with praise and saying, oh, my gosh, maybe we finally found, the target here after decades of searching. Not a single one of those publications wrote a story when the paper was ultimately retracted more than a decade later, facing credible allegations of research misconduct.
When you were starting this investigation, you were warned, saying, do not take this on. Mark Tessier-Levine is well-respected. He's a president of the university. He'd been president of Rockefeller University before that. He was a Rhodes Scholar. I mean, everything about him felt untouchable. So I'm curious about the confidence that you had here as not just a student, but a freshman first quarter student, that you felt like you could keep pursuing this. And I mean, a lot of kids would say, oh my gosh, I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want this to wreck my career. This is too much. What about your own makeup allowed you to keep going?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like once it was clear there was a story here, I don't think there was ever a moment where I considered not reporting on it. It just seemed like this was the obvious thing to do, that, there was something that my community needed to know and that I wanted to understand, and that I was well positioned to try to figure it out. And Mark Tessier Levine had this sterling reputation. Right, he's the first in his family to go to college. He creates an entirely new field of research in the 1990s by discovering the netrin. Right, and this is really fantastic research. Mark Tessier Levine is no fraud in that sense. Right, he is a towering scientific mind. And as people who have now spoken to me, who worked with him at every stage of his career, said, as he began to segue into positions of higher and higher acclaim, he became sort of distant. Hands off, they said. In the judgment of the eventual Stanford investigation, he ended up fostering a lab dynamic that rewarded the winners, that is, the people who could produce the data that he wanted, and marginalized the losers. And this is why the fraud, in their view, began to seep in. It's such a fascinating story to me, and it was very difficult to report, obviously, especially once the president began sicking his high-powered attorneys on
Yeah,
us.
the high-powered attorney part is quite a story. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan. We're talking with Theo Baker about his experience as a Stanford student. His new book is called How to Rule the World. What are your questions for Theo? And are you a current or former Stanford student? What do you think about the school's culture? Do you think that it is serving the students or serving the university? You can give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. I mean, Theo, going back to the institution that is Stanford, I mean, the investigation into the president, kind of the big metaphor here is that when people are prestigious and they do allegedly amazing things, Stanford is willing to turn their eyes, avert their eyes from that, the negative conduct. And you talked about Stan Cohen. There's the university president. There's the board, which, in your story as it unfolds, maybe didn't do the diligence that it needed to do. So what does it say to the students when the grown-ups around them seem so willing to bend rules?
Well, this is, the lesson that so many people seem to learn is that getting ahead is about self-presentation, right? And so this goes back to the very title of the book, How to Rule the World, and the secret class, by the very same
Yes.
name, that teaches students, 12 students a year on the Stanford campus. It teaches them explicitly, in the words of the Silicon Valley CEO who has styled himself as a professor, to quote, extract value from people.
It just, I mean, honestly, when I read that part, I thought, oh, good for you for not taking that class. Good for you for learning something else. So, as you said, you are going to be graduating on June 14th, and your commencement speaker at Stanford is the CEO of Google, Sundar Pichai, which seems like an apt kind of bookend to your book. What does it say to you that the choice of a commencement speaker like Sundar Pichai and it's Stanford's relationship to Silicon Valley?
Well, look, the four commencement speakers in my 4 years have been two athletes and two billionaires, which I guess makes sense. Look, I mean, Stanford has had this great love affair with technology, and it's not wrong to want to celebrate it. I do chuckle to myself a little bit, imagining how many dozens of corporate lawyers and PR people have reviewed that speech before Sundar will give it, especially in light of his predecessor, Eric Schmidt, getting booed for talking about AI at his own commencement speech in Arizona last month. I mean, look, it's Stanford has been very intentional about creating this no boundaries relationship. Right? It's not an accident that this exists here. And it's not an accident that this has allowed Stanford to ascend to its meteoric heights, that this is an institution now with a budget higher than 116 countries, right? That if you just take the cumulative value of companies that have offices on Stanford land, it's somewhere north of $6 trillion. You know, and all of this is encouraged. That's why there was a guy with the moniker Professor Billionaire, because he made $20 billion by investing in his students' companies. And the university even has its own VC fund to seed students' new companies, right? So all of this is very intentional. And to me, it's something of a Faustian bargain, right? That Stanford has allowed for its own ascent by making this deal with Silicon Valley and allowed for some of its corruption.
Well, I think our listeners will have two questions for you as we end our interview. One, what are your plans after graduation? And two, who would you like to have play you in the movie?
Well, I'm not sure about what's going to happen after. I've been just trying to make sure I get to graduation. Don't flunk out at the 5-yard line. As to who should play me, I don't know. I mean, some random 17-year-old kid, right?
I don't know, Theo. I saw you got a blurb from Amy Pascal, big Hollywood producer. So I feel like there is going to be a movie here. And you don't have anybody who you're interested in playing you?
I will say the one casting choice I've thought about and think would be a good one is, like, I would love to see Ralph Fiennes play Mark Tessier Levine. I think that would be a great rendition.
Theo, you could be a casting director too. This has been a super fun interview. So happy to have this conversation. Theo Baker, thanks for joining us here on State of the Bay.
Thanks. This is wonderful.
If you'd like to read How to Rule the World by Theo Baker, it's available at any independent bookstore near you. And coming up after the break, Berkeley documentarian Sarah Doso will be talking to Ann Harper about her new film, Time and Water. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. Our guest tonight is filmmaker Sarah Doso, director of the Oscar-nominated documentary Fire of Love and the new film Time and Water, which premiered earlier this year at the Sundance Film Festival. The film is a meditation on glaciers, memory, family history, and climate change, centered around Icelandic writer Andre Schneer Magnusson and his reflections on a rapidly changing landscape. Sarah Doso, welcome to State of the Bay.
Well, thank you so much, Ann. It's great to be here.
Well, congratulations on this film. It's just stunning. It's visually beautiful and quietly profound. What stayed with me most is just how relevant it feels right now as we humans grapple with our relationship to the natural world. Can you talk about what drew you to this film and a little bit about the story behind it?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for those kind reflections about the film. I think I was first drawn to this story when I read an article entitled, How Do You Say Goodbye to a Glacier? I feel like so many people right now are grappling with how we say goodbye to these landscapes that we're so rapidly losing amid the climate crisis. When I saw the byline of that article that was written by Andre Schneer Magnusson, I got very excited because he's a writer whose work has meant so much to me through the years. He is a celebrated environmentalist and poet and sci-fi writer, but he brings a real sense of play and humor and human emotion into these stories about our planet. Specifically, in his work, he parallels a love story of his grandparents with a love of Iceland as he's watching the ice of Iceland vanish into ocean. And so even though it's a very specific country, a very specific family, a very intimate story, there's something universal that I think so many people are feeling right now, watching their family lives change and watching the landscapes that they love change so much as well.
Yes, you weave together a lot of contemporary footage with a lot of archival material in a way that feels seamless, but also very intimate, like we're part of this lovely family, watching family films together. I imagine that must have been an oddly intimate experience to have with someone as you're going through family film to decide what to use in your documentary.
Yeah, it was very challenging, but very inspiring to work with all of that archival material. Andre's grandparents were some of the first to film Iceland's glaciers, and Andre himself began to film their own lives, really to capture what they loved. So getting to work with that multi-generational archive was an extraordinary gift. I'm so lucky to have worked with incredible editors on the film, Aaron Casper, Jocelyn Chaput, and Mark Harrison. And it was really important for us to put those things in conversation with each other. in a way that hopefully felt like subjective memory, because so much of the film is about memory, the memories we humans, of course, cherish in our own lives, but also planetary memory that one could say becomes encapsulated in the ice of glaciers.
Yeah, I thought that was really elegantly done. At one point, Andre compares photography to the glaciers, and he talks about how photography can capture moments in time and how the glaciers capture moments in time. And he shows visual evidence of volcanic eruptions, for instance, and things like that in the glaciers. And he was asked to write a eulogy for a glacier that was a mere infant in geologic time. It was only 700 years old. And I hadn't thought about the lifespan of a glacier. How did you approach that scale of time in your filmmaking to make it accessible to people?
Oh, that's a great question. It's very challenging to make something so expansive as geologic time feel personal and relatable and human. But I'm very moved by the idea of ancestral memory as being the closest thing that perhaps humans can experience to that depth of geologic time. And what I mean by that is the sharing of stories across generations and how you can reach back into the past and in a way carry that experience into the present and allow that to impact how we conceptualize the future. Mm-hmm. I think Andre talks about this beautifully in his own work. He talks about the handshake of generations, mm-hmm. and that if you can reach out to your elders and also reach out to a loved one, who, whether it's your child or a child that you love in our contemporary world, it's as if you can hold hands on both sides, you can reach a stretch of time. And by doing so, it can't quite speak to the vastness of 4.6 billion years of Earth's existence, but it can still allow us to see an arc of time beyond our own individual human lives. And thus, what we do now clearly impacts not just the present, but the future. And there's something about that framework of geologic time that's hard to work with, but mm-hmm. there's something that for us as a filmmaking team was an extraordinary opportunity to explore these concepts and try to make them feel human and relatable on screen.
Mm-hmm. The critics have especially highlighted the sound design in the film, and you can hear the ice creak and crack and moan. And even the dripping of the water sounds almost like a heartbeat in the film. How intentional was sound in this as a storytelling tool in creating the emotional experience of watching the film?
I love that question. Thank you for that. I love talking about sound. The sound design was extremely intentional in the film. We were incredibly lucky to work with a wonderful sound designer named Bjorn Victorsson. And we wanted audiences to feel the life force of a glacier. Because glaciers move very slowly, they kind of evade human vision. You know, you can't quite see a glacier move, but you can hear it. And so sound was a way that we would really try to articulate that movement in the film. This film is also about a glacier's death, but the more you can feel the glacier's life, the more it becomes visceral and embodied, the more powerful the loss can feel. So it was very important for us to have the best expression we possibly could create using the cinematic tools that were available to us to give glaciers that feel of a life force.
So I understand you spent some time growing up in the Bay Area. Do you feel like the landscapes here or the environmental culture of Northern California helped shape the filmmaker that you've become?
I definitely feel like the Bay has shaped me. I grew up in Berkeley and in Oakland, and I feel so lucky that my parents would take me to Tilden Park in Berkeley as a kid all the time. I feel very connected to that landscape and to the wild landscapes throughout the Bay. As a little one, I was just in awe of the massive trees, of the power of the ocean. And I think that awe and wonderment has really stuck with me, and I think is a kind of fuel for me in my own filmmaking practice. So I've definitely seen nature change in the Bay, and that's been a devastating thing to grapple with myself. But working on the film became a medicine of sorts. And while I don't think our film necessarily posits any easy answers, I hope that it can be a meditation on this new paradigm that we're living in with the climate crisis.
Sarah Dosa is the director of the new documentary Time and Water, which opens in Bay Area theaters this Friday, June 5th. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Oh, thank you so much, Anne. I really appreciate being here.
I'm Chris Nooney, and this is State of the Bay's local news quiz. Each week, we'll ask you a few questions about news stories you might have heard on KALW throughout the week. We'll post the answers on our website after the show airs. Send us an email to let us know how you did. We're at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So let's get to it. First question. The San Francisco Symphony has named a new music director who will officially take the podium at the start of the orchestra's 2027-2028 season. Can you tell us the name of the new director? To help inspire your answer, we're playing a recording of the conductor leading Swan Lake. Next up, which of Mayor Daniel Lurie's top aides recently announced plans to step down at the end of June? And for bonus points, who has the mayor selected to take over the role? Okay, last question. A new professional women's sports team is coming to the Bay Area. Can you name the sport and the city that will host the new team? That's it for today's news quiz. Answers to the quiz will be posted on our website. Join us next week for three new questions about what's happening around the Bay Area.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen. That way you'll never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments or about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at any time, 24/7, at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb, Heather Hughes, Ann Harper, and Chris Nooney. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and Tariq Ansari was our amazing board operator. I'm Grace Wan. Good night. Thanks for listening. We look forward to having you back again.